Thank you and welcome to Scripture on Creation. I'm Scott Kump.
And I'm Dr. Ben Scripture.
Dr. Scripture, today we're continuing in our series, Creation in the Book of Isaiah. In our last program, we considered the statements in Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9, which remind us of the gulf between the ways and thoughts of the Creator and the ways and the thoughts of man.
Yes, Scott, those verses are very often repeated by God's people, especially when we're confused or troubled by the circumstances God brings into our lives. So let's read them.
Okay, verse 8. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord.
For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than yours, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Now, on first glance, it may not seem like this passage relates to creation so much. However, it's the Creator speaking about an aspect of His creative work. On what day, Scott?
Well, if God is referring to how far the stars are above the earth and not just the clouds of earth's atmosphere, the Creator is talking about what He did on the fourth day of creation.
Yes, I think the heavens He's referring to are those of the vast expanse of space. And as we discussed in the last program, so far, we've discovered that distance of the heavens above the earth to be in the neighborhood of about 76 billion light years.
Incredible.
Of course, we don't know, ultimately, how high the heavens really are. But as you pointed out last time, Scott, there is someone who does know.
The one who stretched them out. Oh, and by the way, He knows all the stars by name.
And not one of them is missing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we're discussing Isaiah chapter 40, which is absolutely fantastic. But let's get back to the portion of Isaiah that we're going to study in today's program.
And what would that be?
Well, after God says, "For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways," He then goes on to describe more qualities of His creation. And in this case, the heavens are mentioned again, but not the heavens of day 4. So Scott, let's read verses 10 and 11. You first.
Okay, verse 10. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth and making it bear and sprout and furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater. Okay, Dr. Scripture, I know you're going to read verse 11 also, but I have a question before we move on.
Okay, what is it?
Well, you just made the point that the height of the heavens spoken of in verse 8 and 9 refers to how far the stars are above the earth.
Mm-hmm.
But then immediately here in verse 10, God is undoubtedly talking about the atmospheric heaven where the rain and snow come from. Is it possible that God is also talking about the atmosphere in verse 8 and 9, and He is continuing to refer to that heaven, in other words, the clouds in the sky?
I have to admit, that seems like a very sensible way to understand those references to the heavens in verses 8 and 9. It certainly fits with the possible meaning of heaven. And frankly, keeps all the references to heaven in this passage in the same context. Scott, you may have just changed my whole understanding of the phrase in verse 9, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways. It may be that the emphasis is not how much higher God's ways and thoughts are than ours. In other words, it's not so much a quantitative statement, but rather He's simply making a qualitative statement. The sky is above, and it's higher than the earth, and the quality of His ways are higher than ours.
Well, I didn't mean to rain on your parade.
Well, by no means, Scott. Remember, the goal of our program is not to understand what I say. It's to understand
what Scripture says.
Precisely. And it's sort of ironic that you should mention rain, Scott, because that's what you just read about in verse 10.
True.
So, you know, maybe now with this interruption, you should read verse 10 again.
Okay, Isaiah 55:10 says, "For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth and making it bear and sprout and furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater."
Verse 11, "So shall my word be, which goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, without accomplishing what I desire, and without succeeding in the matter for which I sent it." So here's another statement that God's people often cite. You know, it's sort of interesting how much of Isaiah 55 is applied in contemporary Christian life, isn't it?
It sure is.
And notice what God is describing is the earth's water cycle. Something that our modern-day environmentalists ought to be able to appreciate.
God is the original recycler.
You bet. And of course, the water cycle is absolutely critical for life to exist and be sustained on Earth. It's really fantastic. The balance between liquid water and water vapor, which is directed or controlled by the fluctuations in temperature in the atmosphere and on the land. It's perfect so that it rains, but not all the time. You realize if it rained continually across the whole planet, the erosion would ultimately result in there being no land.
Wow.
And of course, if it didn't rain at all, there'd be no life. And as a bonus, the whole process of evaporation and precipitation purifies the water. I have to shake my head when I think about how many naturalists reason that this precisely balanced, homeostatic, liquid, gaseous water system of the Earth has occurred by chance, that it's simply a wonderful stroke of luck. And therefore, because of that, life was able to spontaneously develop and evolve into the manifold diversity we see today.
Dr. Scripture, I believe that balance between gaseous and liquid water that occurs as a result of the fluctuations in temperature of the Earth is only possible because Earth's distance from and orbit around the sun is just right. Don't the astronomers say Earth is in the Goldilocks zone?
The Goldilocks zone. That's it, Scott. Papa Bear's porridge was too hot. Mama Bear's porridge was too cold, but Baby Bear's porridge was just right. And Goldilocks ate it all up. And that describes the Earth's temperature. Again, according to the evolutionary worldview. They propose it was by chance that Earth was formed and now orbits the sun at the perfect distance and orbital shape, almost a perfect circle, but not exactly a circle,
no.
Which, again, is extremely fortunate considering it was all just blind luck, because the slight movements closer and further away from the sun as it orbits the sun and the tilt of Earth's axis cause the necessary range of temperature fluctuations in the atmosphere so the water cycle happens. And with that idea in mind that this was all by chance, I want to read a statement by a person who truly believed that all these perfectly integrated physical phenomena were in fact chance occurrences. It was written by the late Stephen Jay Gould, a famous evolutionist at Harvard. When he was asked why we were here, he said, quote, "We are here because one odd group of fishes had a peculiar fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures, because Earth never froze entirely during an ice age." Now, he has more to say, but let's stop right there for a moment. What he's referring to is, one, we evolved from fish, and two, it was possible because Earth is in the Goldilocks zone.
How fortunate.
And his claim is those things are totally random occurrences. And so he continues answering why we are here. Quote, "Because a small and tenuous species arising in Africa a quarter of a million years ago managed, so far, to survive by hook and by crook. We may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists. This explanation, though superficially troubling, if not terrifying, is ultimately liberating and exhilarating. We cannot read the meaning of life passively in the facts of nature. We must construct these answers ourselves from our own common and ethical sense. There is no other way." Unquote.
Wow, Dr. Gould not only saw no purpose behind the water cycle or the existence of the human race, but he apparently didn't believe that as individual human beings, there was any real reason for living.
Mm-mm.
You know, no purpose in life other than what you make up for yourself. That is sad and empty.
Oh, but Scott, remember what he went on to say? He acknowledged that at first, that realization may be troubling, but ultimately it was, what did he say? Liberating and exhilarating. Well, how so? Because it means there's no creator to answer to, no authority outside of ourselves to tell us what to do, to establish standards we're obliged to live by. Therefore, we construct our own standards. We are the definers of ethics. Indeed, we determine right and wrong.
And when circumstances change so that the current right and wrong are no longer popular, we just change the standards for what's right and wrong.
Exactly. Man rejects an absolute standard, any absolute laws of right or wrong, and to do that, he therefore rejects the lawgiver, either by claiming he doesn't even exist, or by simply dismissing him. And in fact, that is precisely what God describes people doing later in Isaiah. Listen to this in Isaiah 65, starting at verse 2. I have spread out my hands all day long to a rebellious people, who walk in the way which is not good, following their own thoughts, a people who continually provoke me to my face, who say, keep to yourself, do not come near me, for I am holier than you. These are smoke in my nostrils, a fire that burns all the day. There God is describing rebellious man who says, I'll do it my way. And yet, despite the claims that such a life is liberating and exhilarating, what is the result?
Well, just look at society. The fruit of lawlessness and purposelessness is in all the headlines and on TV screens.
Exactly. I submit we are reaping the results of a worldview that believes everything is a product of chance, a mindset which is completely contrary to what God tells us in His Word and shows us in His creation. Remember when we read those two verses, Isaiah 55, 10 and 11, God first describes the water cycle and explains that this amazing phenomenon, so unique to Earth, indeed has a purpose, and it's one which man then benefits from. The rain and snow waters the earth, quote, making it bear and sprout, and furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater, unquote. And God then uses that as the illustration about His Word, which also has a purpose, one which will be accomplished according to His will. I think the Creator is alluding to what happened back in Genesis 1. What does it say in Genesis 1, 3?
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
Exactly. Nothing more complicated than that. And so with reference to the vegetation, He speaks on day 3, saying, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind. And the earth brought forth vegetation. What He willed was accomplished, and He did so simply with His Word. And the very same thing happens with His Word spoken and recorded in the Bible. Remember, He says, so shall my word be, which goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, without accomplishing what I desire, and without succeeding in the matter for which I sent it. Now that word translated empty in Isaiah 55, 11, sometimes is translated without cause. One example of that is found in Psalm 25, verse 3, which says, quote, indeed, none of those who wait for thee will be ashamed. Those who deal treacherously without cause will be ashamed, unquote. The meaning is, if a person has no reason to deal treacherously with another person, God will put the treacherous one to shame. And so in our verse, God is saying when He speaks, He has a reason, and just like in creation, His Word then accomplishes what He intends. And so what is that Word of the Lord? Here in Isaiah 55, 11, He says, so shall my Word be, which goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, without accomplishing what I desire, and without succeeding in the matter for which I sent it. And that's not what I say, that's what Scripture says.